Well, we're in Hebrews chapter 9. We're going to go through the first, well, head for the first 14 verses. We probably won't make it all the way through the first 14 verses. So let's bow our heads and we'll get started. Father, we thank you so much for this evening. We thank you for the word. We thank you for this chance to look into it. And as always, we ask that we may learn, that we may use it in our own hearts and souls to find guidance and direction and to learn more about you. Again, we thank you for this opportunity. I ask that your spirit would move among us tonight in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, chapter 9 begins by saying, talking about the first covenant, but I want to review real quickly what we talked about last week. It can be summed up in chapter 8, verse 6. Last week, we talked about this. It says, but we went through most of chapter 8 last week. But the ministry Jesus has received is as superior to theirs. Jesus' ministry is as superior to the priest's ministry as the covenant of which he is the mediator. So Jesus' ministry or service is superior to the priest. The covenant that Jesus represents is superior to their covenant. And it says this right here, of which he is the mediator, is superior to the old one. And this is the main point, and it is founded on better promises. So Jesus is a better service, Jesus is a better covenant, and it's founded on better promises. And then we go back to the old covenant to find the promises that are in the new covenant, or the criteria of the new covenant is actually found in the old covenant. So what we said last week, what he's saying to the writers, is here they've got the old covenant. We'll just write Old Testament. They've got the Old Testament, and in this New Testament that we've got here, now don't just think of the new letters, the new part of the Bible, but the new covenant that we're in Christ, we are in this new covenant. But these writers, or these readers, are wanting to go back to the Old Testament or the Old Covenant. They say, well, we're thinking about going back here. But the writer now is saying, this covenant has a better service in Jesus. He's got a better covenant, and also the promises that come with that covenant are better. Back here in the Old Testament, the covenant promises were basically, you do everything right, God will bless you. That was, you do this, God will do this. That was the covenant. The promises in this New Testament or the New Covenant are better than that, but amazingly, guess where they're recorded? They're recorded back here. In other words, this old covenant itself was talking about and telling the people there is a new covenant coming. So the New Covenant is not in violation to the old covenant, it's in fulfillment of it. It was something that they said, this is temporary, there's a new one coming. And then we see in the rest of these verses right here, as we go back to the Old Testament, go back to Jeremiah, we begin to read here up to the end of this chapter out of Jeremiah 31. It says, but God found fault, we're in verse 8, but God found fault with the people and says, the time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant. So again, that's right out of the Old Testament. Notice what God says, I found fault with the people. There wasn't anything wrong with this Old Testament. The problem was with the people back here. The people had a fault. The people had a flaw. He says, so there, I found fault with this. This isn't going to work. So I need a new covenant. And now this new covenant, obviously, you can't just take these same people. Now watch, you just can't take these same people and give them a new covenant. Because what was wrong with the old covenant? The people. So if you give them a covenant B up here and put those same people in covenant B, what's going to happen up here? The people are going to mess it up again. You can have covenant C. And it's like, the problem's not with the covenant. The problem is with the people you keep making the covenant with. So clearly, this New Testament or the New Covenant, if we think about it, is going to be with the same people, but there's going to have to be something more powerful about it. And we read through this, and we've got these promises right here. The first promise we see without reading this whole thing is in verse 10. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel. After that time, declares the Lord, I will put my laws on their minds and write them on their hearts. He says, I'm going to put the laws on their hearts. I'm going to put it in them. Something's going to change. Again, noticing the nature of the people. The second one, nor longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother saying, know the Lord, because they will all know me. And so we're going to write down here, personal relationship or personal knowledge. The hearts or nature will be changed, and their relationship, they're going to have a personal, everyone involved in this covenant is going to know God personally. It's not like there's going to be a priest coming and say, I want to tell you about the Lord. I want you to do these rituals. Well, I don't really know the Lord. You don't need to know the Lord. You just need to do these rituals. It's like we're going to change the man's nature. God's going to have a personal relationship, and you're not going to be a priest coming to somebody saying, hey, you need to know the Lord. instead, everybody who's in this covenant will know the Lord. Now, again, we are talking in this covenant, we are not talking about evangelism, of going out and bringing people into the covenant. It's if anybody is in this covenant, they know the Lord. Again, people that do not know the Lord or aren't saved, obviously, well, they're not in the covenant yet. And then verse 12, for I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more. The key word being remember. And this is more in the Hebrew word, this is more than recollection. I remember that you sinned. Remember, whenever God would remember the wickedness of the people, it meant he wasn't just going, oh yeah, that's right, they really made me mad back there. It was, he remembers the sin and, oh, that's right, I need to take action against them. So this remembrance was more than just a memory recall. It was a taking action to justify that wrong. And so when he says, I'll remember their sins no more, it doesn't just mean he forgot about their sins. It means he is no longer going to justify himself with their sins, meaning their sins have been dealt with. They're no longer an issue for him. A new nature, a personal relationship, and the sins have been dealt with. Those are the better promises. So when you read chapter 9, verse 6 again, or chapter 8, verse 6 again, but the ministry Jesus has received is as superior to theirs as the covenant of which he is the mediator is superior to the old one, and it is founded on better promises. And these are those promises of that new covenant. Now, we begin chapter 9 right after he established this new covenant and said he has a better promises in the new covenant, of which we are excited about. He begins here in chapter 9. Now, this first covenant had regulations for worship. And so, again, we're going to spend tonight now going back and talking about this old covenant or the Old Testament. And besides the promises that came along with it, besides the service of the priest, the covenant had rituals. It had a covenant had regulations for worship, it says right here. These are the things they had to do. And we're going to talk just briefly, and it is briefly. We're going to spend the whole night talking about it. But what we're going to see right here is in these next five verses, this writer is going to skim across the surface. And if he wanted to, he could have settled on any one of those points and wrote volumes. And he probably has at some place in his life. But right now, he's just skimming through. Let's read this. So watch how much ground he covers right here. And we're going to talk about this tonight. Now the first covenant had regulations for worship and also an earthly sanctuary. A tabernacle was set up. In its first room were the lampstands, the table, and the consecrated bread that was called the holy place. Behind the second curtain was a room called the most holy place, which had the golden altar of incense and the gold-covered Ark of the Covenant. This ark contained the gold jar of manna, Aaron's staff that had budded, and the stone tablets of the covenant. Above the ark were the cherubim of the glory, overshadowing the atonement cover. But we cannot discuss these things in detail now. When everything had been arranged like this, the priests entered regularly into the outer room to carry on their ministry. But only the high priest entered the inner room, and that only once a year. Now, we're going to stop right there. That's probably all the further we're going to want to get. Because what he's heading for, he is going to, in this old covenant, they had rules and regulations for worship. And then he's going to go ahead and he's going to describe for them the tabernacle. Now, the tabernacle was going to be, turn the page, to go to page 4. We're going to come back and look at some pictures there on page 1, 2, and 3. But on page 4 at the top, I've got a list of reasons why he talks about the tabernacle instead of the temple. Why not talk about the temple of Solomon or the temple of Zerubbabel or the temple that is in Jerusalem? Instead, he talks about the tabernacle, the tent in the wilderness. Well, here's seven. We don't know for sure why he does this, but we can assume possibly. Number one, the tabernacle was the original sanctuary. Number two, the tabernacle plans were given to Moses. Moses is one of their superstars. God told Moses, make the tabernacle. He didn't tell Moses to make the temple. He told him to make a tabernacle. So it was original. It came from Moses. The Torah, the first five books of the Bible, the foundation of their religion, gives all the dimensions of this tabernacle. The tabernacle was by design temporary and movable. Realizing that this tabernacle, even as they established it at Mount Sinai, they carried it around for 40 years. It was designed to be picked up and moved somewhere else. It wasn't permanent, which gives a whole reading into this this old covenant was, it was just temporary. It was just something, we're going to put up a tent, it's going to cover us for this amount of time, and then we're going to move on to something else. So even the tabernacle itself was movable and temporary, even replaced by the temple. Number five, the temple in the days of the writing of this book of Hebrews was known to be corrupt. So if we go back to the temple in Jerusalem, many people, especially when we talk about the Qumran community, they had left the temple. Many of the priests, if we consider John the Baptist, was one of the priests or came from the priestly family. He was out in the wilderness with the Qumran society or community because they had had enough of the religious organization. They believed in the temple, they believed in the law, but they saw it's not happening in the temple. And so they felt justified in pulling out and leaving. And so to use the temple as an example in those days was not a good, clear illustration. It was better to go back to more of a romantic time of the tabernacle in the wilderness. And we can even remember back then Nadab and Abihu died in the tabernacle because they didn't follow the proper prescriptions for the incense. They had all kinds of problems even back then. But really, the temple itself was corrupt, and possibly it was easier to talk about the tabernacle and get, again, the true image. The temple in Jerusalem was built as a replica of the wilderness temple. So if the tabernacle was a copy of what is in heaven, well, then the temple was a copy of the tabernacle that was a copy, because almost like a second generation thing. And the people receiving this letter were probably not in Jerusalem. So they weren't like looking at the temple every day. They were probably outside, possibly in a Gentile city somewhere, and they could easier associate with the wilderness people in their tabernacle with their own personal life. But nonetheless, the tabernacle was 150 feet long this way. It was 75 feet across here, wide, with a gate here that, of course, faced east. Inside, this is the courtyard. This was all exposed. The sun shining out. This is just like a fence. That would go around, you know, not a real high fence. It was a movable fence. Then right in here was a tent. This tent, as you can see, I've got these dimensions. Let's go back to the first page there. You can see there at the top picture there, very clearly, you can see the outer court with the altar of burnt offering right here. The bronze basin right here. Both of these are bronze. This is where they burnt the sacrifices. This is where they had water, a reservoir of water. And then, of course, the tent right here. And this tent, as you can see in the picture right below that first one, gives you the dimensions. It's 45 feet this way. It's 15 feet here. This is a square right here. It's 15 feet by 15 feet, this square right here. This is the most holy place. And this, of course, would be 30 feet right here. This is the outer court. This is called the holy place. Right here. This is called the most holy place. There is a curtain across here that they could enter into that area once a year. And then, of course, the furniture was set up. There's a lampstand on this side on the left. There's the table of showbread here on the right with 12 loaves of bread replaced every Sabbath. And then the altar of incense, which we're going to talk about all this tonight just briefly. But this altar of incense was sitting outside this curtain, but when they burnt incense, that fragrance would actually permeate this curtain and go past. Is a sample of prayer. They could pray or burn incense out here, but the actual fragrance would actually carry on back into the presence of where the Lord was. And this is back in here was where the Ark of the Covenant was sitting. Now if you turn, you can see all those diagrams there on your second image. Turn to page 2, please. Just real quickly, this is an image I found on the internet. Again, you go on the left side, that image 3, you've got the same thing I've showed you here on the board. But the one on the right would be the heavenly temple. And this is taken from different illustrations from Ezekiel when the Lord shows up in chapter 1, or they see the chariot of God moving in chapter 10, Revelation chapter 4, 5, and 6 in there. You can see, even chapters 1, 2, and 3, when the Lord is among the seven golden lampstands. The cherubim are there. That's kind of an image of how it correlates with the actual temple. Then at the bottom of the page, you can see again another drawing. There you got a cutaway view of the tabernacle, and you see inside. And notice that this holy place, contrary to what I drew here, the rectangular shape, was a perfect cube. It was a perfect square, as wide as it was long as it was high, which is exactly the way it is in the temple of Solomon. Again, imagining it again. This is not real big. I brought a tape measure tonight. Tony, can I have some help here, please? Yeah, I want to just take this right here. There we have group participation here. All right, here we go. This right here. Oh, stop! Stop right there. This right here. No, over more. I need more. Right there. Good. Perfect. Right there. No, I know. This time teasing you. This is 15. This we're ab living. Although we've done this many times, haven't we? This is 15 feet right here. And so 15 feet, that's how far across this thing was. So within here is going to be the Ark of the Covenant. And again, if we went 15 feet across the other way, okay, I'm going to bring it back here. Okay. Now she's just being difficult. I'm going to hook it here if I can. There you go, right there. And it's just, yeah, I don't even remember how long this room is. This is 13. There we go to the window. Right there's 15. Right there's 15. All right. So there's our cube right there. That's how big. So it's like, man, this is a crowded place. This is the holy place, or the most holy place in, you know, well, okay, it's not the most holy place, but it's similar to size of this right here. So it gives you perspective on how big this is. This whole thing could fit on our property right here. I mean, it's not like this huge, again, they're moving it around, they're carrying the thing around. But it's you imagine 2 million people worshiping here. Your church is big enough, you know, just you gotta get a rotation going. But nonetheless, turn the page. One of the things that I was in Israel this summer, and we went to Shiloh. Now, when they carry this around the wilderness for 40 years, and they cross the Jordan River, remember the priests step in the water with the Ark of the Covenant, the water stops. They cross over and they conquer the land in 5 years. They have the central campaign, the southern campaign, they have the northern campaign, and in 5 years they've pretty much conquered and established their position in the land. They take this tabernacle, and they set it up in Shiloh. Real quickly, here's the Galilee, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea. Here would be Jerusalem. Shiloh is right about here. That's Shiloh. And this is when he began 1 Samuel. That's where Eli the priest was at, and that's where Hannah brought her little boy Samuel. Samuel grew up just right here. Right over here is the sea where Samuel grew up. So right in this, the Ramah, this whole area right here is just, you know, a few miles apart. But anyway, we went to Shiloh this summer. And it's just a where Shiloh, the ancient Shiloh's at, it's just a barren hill right now. In fact, there's a picture of it right there. If you look at that second picture there at the on the bottom of that row of rocks, and if you look up that hill, you can see that little structure on the top of that hill, right? That's where I was standing when I took the picture that's above it. I'm looking down at that pile of rocks. So those pictures are just reversed, if you understand what I'm saying. And as you look down at that, on that location, in 1 Samuel, go to 1 Samuel, please. Let's just do this. Go to 1 Samuel. And when I've taught through 1 Samuel, I would always come to this verse and this, and I'd read this. It's like, well, what? Didn't the people know it was a tabernacle? I mean, well, look at this right here. 1 Samuel chapter 1. And it's got the story of Hannah coming to the temple there. And we'll begin in chapter 1, verse 9. And Hannah would go with her husband and his other wife, and they would go and they'd have a meal there. And, of course, Peniel was the other lady's name, and she had sons and daughters, and so they had a little family get-together, but Hannah was just lonely. Chapter 1, verse 9. Once, when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, they'd gone to worship at the temple or the tabernacle, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on a chair by the doorpost of the Lord's, what's the word say? Temple. Now, this would be right in this general area, by a doorpost right out here. This is where Eli was sitting, maybe on this side, maybe on this side. I like to think he's sitting over here, because it's what I want to think. But he was sitting outside right here. But notice what it says. It doesn't say the tabernacle. It clearly says the temple. And the word there means a permanent structure. But we know it wasn't a temple because we know it was a tabernacle. But what they had done, because they had made it permanent, they're no longer traveling. And they're not picking this thing up every 20 minutes or every 20 days and carrying it somewhere else. It was at Shiloh. And it's not going to move. And it's been there all the way through the periods of the rest of Joshua and all the way through the period of the Judges. It had been sitting here at Shiloh. So it had become a permanent structure. And when I say permanent, it appears that they had built a foundation, some kind of a rock wall around this thing right here. And then that was where the fence was. And then, of course, the temple would be on the inside here. The tent would be on the inside of this structure. Now, if you look as you looked up, when I was at Shiloh, and we're on the top of that hill, you can see on the second picture on the bottom there, we're standing on top of that hill by that structure, looking down at that row of rocks. What I'm looking at there in this picture is, look at the top picture now, is a foundation. I'm going to erase this now. As we're looking down there, and here's the picture that you're looking at, you can see I've got a rectangle drawn out there, 150 feet by 75 feet. You could see a row of rocks right here, just the remains, and it's 3,000 years old. And it's just, there's grass growing in it, and some are missing and it's knocked over, but you could clearly see the rectangular shape. Now, when we were standing up there on that little structure on the top of that hill in that second picture, it was very windy. It was just a normal day, but the wind, it was later in the afternoon, and the wind was very strong. Not a good place to put a tent. But if you went down to the base, not the base of that hill, but just went down a little bit on the lower part there on the back side of the hill where that structure is at, where that frame's at, you can still see the hill continues down. The wind stopped. I mean, it was a perfect place to have some kind of a structure like this. Now, you can see how it would have laid out right there. I've got the things drawn in there where in that part right there, you can see where I've got where the tent would have been standing, and back in here would have been where the ark was at. We're just walking around there. Now, if you look down there on the second picture, I am standing now, in that picture, I'm standing right here taking a picture this way. That is a picture of the back wall of where the temple or the tabernacle would have stood. Okay, and again, I've got a whole lot more pictures that you can look at. I think there it is on the middle of that page right there. You can see the Generation Word site there. You can click on that or, you know, whatever, and you can see more pictures of this. And also, you can see right there on the where it says 75 feet, it says 75 feet right here. Eli, in that story in 1 Samuel, would have been sitting, if he's on the right side where I want him, or he could have been over here, he would have been sitting in his chair right there when Hannah would have approached him, and they were going to come in, and here would have been the altar, here would have been the bronze basin, the priest would have entered into here, and this would have been the lampstand, the table of showbread, and then right there the incense altar. And that's probably where the tabernacle would have stood. We don't know for sure. It doesn't say tabernacle stood here. But what we do know, it was at Shiloh. This is Shiloh. And there's the dimensions and the proportions on a very good place. And it's something that had been there for hundreds of years before it was removed. And you remember what happens then. The Israelites go off to war against the Philistines. And they get defeated. So they come back in here. They convince the priest to go get the Ark of the Covenant, bring the thing out and go to battle against the Philistines with it and think they're going to win. But it's not a magic box. It's not a good luck charm. God is a real person. He's not pleased with them, and they are utterly defeated. And the Philistines capture the ark. Then it's passed through the land of the Philistines. So finally, the Philistines send it back. Okay, since we're in this story very quickly, here's Galilee, Jordan, and the Dead Sea. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. Here's the land of the Philistines. Here's Shiloh. They went to battle right up in this area. The Philistines met them right here. They captured the ark and took it back down through the five Philistine cities and finally headed it back up here. And they put it on a cart with two cows pulling it. And it ends up being right about in here. It ends up on a farm place for a couple generations as it just waits until David conquers Jerusalem. And then David sends for the Ark of the Covenant and brings it to Jerusalem. Remember, in David's time, the priests had moved to a place called Nob right over here. But they did not have the tabernacle any longer because it had been burnt to the ground by the Philistines. After that battle, the Philistines just kept on coming and burnt the tabernacle to the ground. Some of the things were saved. The priests were saved. Jeremiah even uses this event of the burning of Shiloh and the tabernacle in his message to the Jews in Jerusalem in 600, 605, 610 BC, when they say, God will never destroy this temple. And he says, go to Shiloh. What do you see at Shiloh? Well, you see this right here at Shiloh. He says, just take a hike, take a family trip up there and take a look. He says, what's at Shiloh? Nothing. That used to be the holy place. And God got ticked and burnt it to the ground. He says, I wouldn't push it. He says, I think I'm right. I've got Bible verses on my side, he's saying. And of course, that's exactly what happened. And again, the ark then comes from this farm place up here to Kiriath-Jearim, I think is how you say it. Comes up here and is brought into the city of Jerusalem during David's time. Then Solomon builds the magnificent temple and the ark is placed in the temple of Solomon. And then around 586, the Babylonian invasion, and they burned the city to the ground. We'll talk about that here later tonight. And that's the last we hear of the Ark of the Covenant. It doesn't even say they took it. It doesn't even say it was there. is just silent. But meaning did it get, people don't know. And so it remains a mystery what happened to the Ark of the Covenant. We'll maybe talk about that here if I hurry some more. But anyway, I thought you may find that interesting a little bit about that. Turn the page 4. Now, back in Hebrews chapter 9. Again, the writer of Hebrews is going back to this tabernacle. This is his illustration. And he's just breezing through it. Basically, all he's doing, we're going to do a little bit more than he's doing here tonight. You know, remember what he says, but we cannot discuss these things in detail now. He's moving on. We're going to slow down just a little bit and take a snapshot of it a little bit longer. But what he's doing is he's taking a look at this right here, and he's saying, now, this is all temporary, but there's something greater. And of course, he's taking this as he always has, where he talks about angels and says the Son is greater. Talks about Moses, says the builder of the house is greater. Talks about the covenant, says his Jesus' covenant is better. They've got priests, Jesus is a better priest. Now they've got service, and he's going to now eventually talk about, as we end this tonight, what he's going to end up saying about this whole thing was he just wants to get to the place and tell them, once a year the priest brought blood back into here, into the holy place. Two types of blood. One, he brought the blood of a bullock for the priest and his family. And two, he brought the blood of a goat for the sins of the people. That is what he did every year. And that's really what he's talking about. Because then he's going to say, and so, now, if Jesus has a covenant, and Jesus has a sanctuary, and Jesus has a service to perform, then what did Jesus bring? And then he's going to talk about, in the real temple, he brought his own blood, and that's where this is all heading for, is all about the Day of Atonement, or Yom Kippur. But we're going to go back and slow down a little bit. Chapter 9, verse 1. Now, this first covenant had regulations for worship and also an earthly sanctuary, the tabernacle. Verse 2. A tabernacle was set up. In the first room were the lampstand and the table and the consecrated bread. This was the holy place. So now we're going to expand this again. And what we've got here is the tent itself. This is just the tent, and they would enter into this door right here. There's your cube, 15 by 15 feet, the most holy place. Here's the holy place. And it's what he says here is going to cause us some problems later on. It's something that we've got to deal with. He says, in this holy place, this was the most holy place. This outer room was the holy place, was the lampstand, the table of showbread, with the 12 loaves of bread on it. He says, this was the holy place. I'm going to read it again. A tabernacle was set up. In the first room were the lampstand, the table, and the consecrated bread. This was called the holy place. Now, he is leaving something out, according to our understanding. He's leaving out of this room the altar of incense. Now, don't get that confused. Out here, outside, remember, there was the altar of burnt offering made of bronze where they'd burn the animals. But they would take the blood, and they'd bring, once a year, they put blood on the horns of this altar, which are just little horns on the corners, and then they'd go back and put blood on the mercy seat back here. But this altar right here is in the holy place. We'll try and talk about that here a little bit. But he is going to say in the next verse that that altar is in here. And it's like, well, now it gives us all kinds of problems. What is going on here? So we'll talk about that a little bit. But now we're focused on the furniture out here. Again, just so we know, I'm sorry, this is part of me as a teacher, I'm preparing you for a test that you're never going to take. But here's the furniture. The furniture that we would consider would be the altar, a burnt offering, the bronze basin, the lampstand, the table of showbread, the altar of incense, and then the Ark of the Covenant, which is the box covered with the mercy seat, which is on top. So in that sense, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6... maybe 7, if you want to count that as two parts, because it is described as two parts. Those are the pieces of furniture. He's going to talk about the lampstand. The first lampstand we got is the menorah. And I've got a picture just because it's interesting, I think. Is the menorah was in the tabernacle, a lampstand with 7 lamps on it. Solomon is going to make a little bit bigger and build several of them. But then they come back to after the captivity and they rebuild the temple, Zerubbabel's temple, which is renovated into Herod's temple, which is a much larger, beautiful temple of Jesus' day. And they had a lampstand in there. And when in 70 AD, when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, they'd spent 3 years under siege, and then finally they broke through. And they didn't want to burn the temple. The command that day was do not destroy the temple. It was a magnificent building. Well, the Jews were revolting and causing trouble and still were fighting and shooting and killing Roman soldiers from the temple. And the soldiers just got ticked. And they stormed the temple and set it on fire. Almost accidentally, but once the thing started burning, it just went up in smoke. And they burnt the temple to the ground, and then they just, you know, tore all the stones down. It's interesting. The command of the Romans was don't burn down the temple. But Jesus' prophecy was not one stone be left upon another. So the Romans are there to destroy Jerusalem on a limited basis. But Jesus is saying, no, you're going to take the whole thing down. And they end up doing contrary to their own. The Jews don't want it destroyed. The Romans don't want it destroyed. Guess who wants the temple destroyed? Jesus. The Lord wanted the temple destroyed. And guess what happened? The Jews couldn't stop it. The Jews couldn't prevent it. And it came down and there's nothing left of it. There's not a brick left of this temple. Okay, well, some of the walls, there's different things, the rubble and stuff, but anyway, that's another part. We don't need to get too far in the archaeology there. But nonetheless, here it is. When the Romans came through, they brought all the stuff back. They brought 50,000 Jewish slaves back to Rome. Those Romans, the Jewish slaves, were probably the ones who built the Colosseum. But one thing we know that they built was that picture right there on page 4. It's called the Arch of Titus. Titus was the general in charge. Vespasian was his father, and Vespasian was the emperor. Titus was his son, and Titus will eventually become the emperor. But he was the one there that finished the job of Jerusalem. And in 81 AD, they built this arch to Titus. And you see right there, on the very top, you see the top up there, you can see the letters that are carved in there. You can still see this today. And you see it says something about the Senate, and you can all right in there, you can read the Latin there. But it means this: the Senate and the people of Rome dedicate to the divine Titus Vespasianus, Augustus, son of the divine Vespasian.
It's still standing.
It's still there. And have you seen it? You've seen it? And so you can see many pictures on the internet. I've got some more right there. Online, if you go online and look at these notes, these links will be live, and you just click them, they'll take you there. Otherwise, you've got to type all that in. Well, turn the page. I just want to show you. You can see right there, I've got written in there, Relief of Menorah. See, I got it pointing on the inside of that arch. So here's the arch right up here. On the inside right here, as you walk through there, Jews were brought down here. Some of the popes at different times in church history have forced the Jews who are living in Italy to come here once a year and stand by this arch and swear allegiance to the Roman Empire or to the Vatican or whatever. Jews today, most of them won't walk through there because it's a memorial to their destruction, and they won't have anything to do with it. Also, we'll turn the page. Here's that. Look, now you got two pictures there on the next page here, page 5, inside that arch. And you can see the relief there of a procession, and carrying, you see very clearly, carrying the menorah, and this is the procession commemorating Titus's destruction of Jerusalem, and this is a picture of the soldiers carrying off the plunder. You can see as you get close to that picture, some of the two, in fact, down below the page there, you've got a close-up of the menorah, and then it looks like they're carrying some kind of like, it looks like a TV camera on a pole there. Of course, it's not a TV camera, unless CNN was there covering it. Okay. But you got different tools there and instruments from the temple itself. And these are Roman soldiers carrying the Jewish menorah back to Rome. Now, we do not know where that menorah is at. But there are enough Jews who are fully convinced that it is in the Vatican. It went to Rome and it stayed in Rome. And they've asked for it back and they never get a response. You can read all this on the internet. It's all just, you know, who knows what's true on the internet. I hope my notes are true. But anyway, they think it's there. And many of the priests have been there and have said, yes, it is downstairs. But we're never going to get it out. So apparently this menorah did make it to Rome. You can see right here in the inscription. But where did it go after that? Some people say it's still there waiting. Turn the page, please, and you've got this is, again, just a closer picture of the menorah, or that lampstand that stood in the tabernacle. That's a close-up of that relief on Titus's arch. We just keep getting closer to it. And then if you turn the page, again, here's a picture I took this summer. In Jerusalem, in the ancient city, the old city of Jerusalem, there is a, here's just as a real general, here's the layout of the city. There's a road that in the Crusaders' day was a main street that ran right down the middle of the city right there. And you can see this on some old mosaic maps that are found in ancient churches, or one particular one at least. And this was called the Cardo. The Cardo. It had a road, it had posts or pillars right here with a sidewalk, and then it had shops along the side right here. This all posts, sidewalk with the shops right up here. This was the main highway during the Crusaders' day. Well, of course, now it was destroyed and rubble is built up on it. And now what you're looking at right here, oh, is this even in here? I don't even have this in here. I'm not ashamed to be telling you that. That's not even in here. But anyway, this is down in the Cardo. This glass case has the gold menorah in it. And you can see if you look on this picture and then flip it over and look on the other page, they look the same because they use this inscription, or part of this, is there, plus Josephus' description, the biblical description. This illustration here is what they used to design, or partly design, this menorah. It is called the Temple Institute. And the Temple Institute is a group of people over there that are collecting all the parts, and this belongs to the Temple Institute, all the parts for the new temple that they believe they're going to build someday. I went to this Temple Institute this summer. I think I told you before, I walked right past it at one time. I'm looking for it, got the address, walked right past it. It's just a little shop. But you had to go in the shop, they got little trinkets and stuff and old things and pictures. And you go in the back, it's still old. And they had little rooms back there, all the parts for the temple. They had the priestly garments. And they had a little tour they were giving, and I kind of snuck in on the tour. And it was, I told you this before, right? But it was a German tour. It was a group of people from Germany. And so they were speaking Hebrew to a translator who was translating it into German. And I was there for the tour. And I was just, I didn't say anything. They thought I was part of the group, you know. I just sat there and,
you know. Did you understand a little bit of it because of your German background?
No. My dad only taught me like Dummkopf and things like this. Yeah. You know. Now, I learned a few German words when I was a kid from my great uncles because they came over from the old country. So I was around them and they spoke German, but the only words that I learned were things that a 5, 6, 7-year-old boy would learn when they says, you know, shut up, get out of the way. Yeah, but I remember hearing them talk, and they sounded the same. I recognize the language, but it's like no understanding. But yeah, anyway, this is the menorah that was there. Now, this menorah in December this year, and this is, I'm sorry, I'm kind of just making this up as I'm going, but this winter, December, it's still winter, it's going to be winter forever, always winter, never Christmas. In December, which is Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights, they took this menorah from the Cardo, which is, you know, there, and they moved it up to the Western Wall. And on my website, I've got a live camera. You can click on it, live webcam of the Western Wall, just 24 hours a day, it shows you the Western Wall. You could see that menorah sitting. They brought it in, and people would go up, and they'd pray by it, and they could look at it and stuff. Well, they've moved it to the Western Wall, and then they never brought it back to the Cardo. They took it, and it's just sitting right just up from the Temple Mount. Now, it's not sitting down on the Temple Mount, but it's just sitting right up just a few feet away in a shop there. So it's now closer. It's saying it's a move towards progress. We've got it from the Cardo. We've got it up within walking distance of the Temple Mount. And they're just, you know, it's a sign of victory for them. Now, you can understand what's going on when you look at this. This back here, the Arch of Titus from 81 AD, celebrating the destruction of the temple and the carrying off of the menorah. And now, 2,000 years later, the victory of having a menorah in the Cardo from the Temple Institute, and now they've got it up by the wall. It's like, we're coming back, they're saying. We are coming back. And so, I mean, you've got monuments from Rome all the way over to the Middle East of the first temple, the destruction of that temple, and now, or I guess it would be the second temple, and then destruction of the temple, now the rebuilding of it. But nonetheless, turn the page. We are in chapter 9, verse 2. A tabernacle was set up. In its first room was the lampstand, the menorah, the table, and the consecrated bread. The table now is right, as you saw right here, it's just sitting right over here. And now, here, I've got the dimensions written down there for you. Yeah, there it is. Now watch this. Here's my tape measure. Ready? The dimensions of this table, it's made out of acacia wood, and then it's covered with gold. And you can see a picture of it right there. The table was 3 feet long. You ready? 3 feet. That's how long the table is, okay? It is 1 foot, 6 inches wide. So here we come right there, 18 inches. That's how wide it is. And it is 2 feet, 3 inches tall. 2 feet, 3 inches tall, right there. That's how tall it is. So this is the table of showbread. And again, you can see it's got rings in it with the poles to carry it. When they carried it out, it's made of solid gold. The parts of it were, they'd have gold plates, spoons, jars, and bowls. And you see some of those sitting there. And then they got two stacks or two rows of bread, six in each stack. And they'd come in every Sabbath and they'd exchange it. And then the priest would eat that bread. You can see the Hebrew phrase in that first bullet point, the showbread or the table of showbread. Showbread is the Hebrew phrase for lahem, I'm going to try and pronounce it, lahem hama ereket, okay, which means the bread of the face or the bread of the presence. Because this bread, the idea here, and it's not just an idea, it's the way it was, this was the presence of the Lord, but you just couldn't walk in behind that curtain. So this was as close as you would come in your daily activities as a priest. And of course, the lampstand would have to be tended every morning, tended every evening, and then the bread would be sitting there, and then every Sabbath, they'd change the bread, and then the priest would eat the bread of the presence that had sat in the presence of the Lord for a whole week, then they would eat that bread. Now, they were telling us this summer when we were over there that the traditional belief is that that bread was always fresh. It was still warm. After sitting there for a week, it was still like eating it right out of the oven. Now,
I'm trying to figure that out because I bake bread.
Yeah.
And I've got a bread board, and I know it's 3 feet long. And I can't get 6 loaves of bread on my bread board, and it won't stay fresh for a week.
Well, yeah. That's what they're saying. But they would eat it. Now the Bible says that they did eat it. And that's part of the Bible. The tradition, the lore is that it was always fresh.
Isn't that something?
I mean, so now again, obviously they're eating it, and it's like, yeah. Great, today's Sabbath, we got to go eat the crummy bread, you know. So I don't know, Milton.
And then this is the bread that David snuck in. And...
Yep, exactly. Now again, when we go back to the story of David, here's the Mediterranean Sea, Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea. Here's Nob. Again, Shiloh had been burnt to the ground. David goes past Jerusalem. He's coming from down south in here. No. He's coming from Saul's city right here. So he'd be just north. Wasn't coming very far at all. He fled from Saul and went up to the city of Nob, where the priests now were sitting. And of course, they had reorganized. Their tabernacle had been burnt, earlier, a generation earlier. And so they've regrouped in the city of Nob. So they had something set up, some kind of a tabernacle set up. It was an arkless tabernacles. The ark was still down here in the farm place. But they did have some kind of showbread, and they had some kind of a tabernacle set up. And when David arrives, he lies to the priest and says he's on a secret journey. So secret, we didn't have time to bring any of my men, any weapons, or any supplies. No food. It's so secret. And the priest goes, wow, this is like James Bond. Yeah. David says, so do you have any weapons, and do you have any bread, any food? And the priest says, no, the only bread we've got is what's in the temple. That's the consecrated bread. And David says, good enough. And so the priest goes in there, a day early or 2 days early or on a Wednesday afternoon or whatever, grabs the bread from the presence of the Lord off the table of showbread or whatever they had redesigned there, and brings it out and says, here you go, David. And David says, how about a weapon? He goes, well, back in here, and they had different things that we're going to find out later tonight, that in the Ark of the Covenant, there's three things originally placed in the Ark of the Covenant. The jar of manna as a sign of God's provision, Aaron's rod that budded, a sign of the priesthood was established by God, and you can't change because they had a little rebellion. And then, of course, the stone tablets of the covenant, or the stone tablets with the law of Moses written on it, that God had, the Ten Commandments that God had given Moses that he'd smashed and then he had to carve it about himself. Those were back in here. Now, it is clear in Scripture that the stone tablets were in the ark. This writer, and I obviously have to agree with him, says the jar of manna and the rod that budded were also in the ark. But when you go back and read the Old Testament account, Moses simply says, put them in the presence of the Lord. So we know that they were, if you read the Old Testament account, it appears that they could have just been setting back in here. sitting back there by the ark in the presence of the Lord. And when David says, I need a weapon, the priest goes back here somewhere and brings out Goliath's sword. In other words, after he had killed Goliath, David had dedicated it to the priest. Hey, you know, we've got the jar of manna, we've got the rod that budded, we've got the Ten Commandments. Hey, this is a big event for Israel. Here's Goliath's sword. And so now they bring it out and give it to David. So apparently that may have been placed back in there also. We just know that the priest went back and got it behind one of the curtains there. Again, it's kind of a funny story to tell, because why does David want Goliath's sword? I mean, it didn't do Goliath any good. You know, and so David obviously is in a mode right there where when he fought Goliath, it was one of the high points of his life, he's trusting God. Now he's at one of the low points of his life where he's actually trusting Goliath's sword, which he and the Lord had defeated earlier, so he's way out of balance. And of course, we've all been there, and we'll probably all get there again sometime. But nonetheless, we should avoid it. But anyway, that's the table of showbread is right there. And you can see, again, that picture. I'm trying to see if there's anything else right there. But anyway, that's the bread of the presence. Okay? Any questions on that? So all we've talked about so far is the lampstand, the menorah, and the table of showbread with the 12 loaves of bread that were changed every Sabbath back there. Now, the next verse. Chapter 9, verse 2. I'll read chapter 9, verse 2 and read to verse 3. A tabernacle was set up in its first room where the lampstand and the table and the consecrated bread. This was called the holy place. Behind the second curtain was a room called the most holy place. And that's that 15 by 15 by 15 cubicle room all laid out in gold. That is called the most holy place. But he says behind the second curtain. And this again, if you've had this scribbling drawing going on right here. This is that second curtain. Why does he call it the second curtain? What is the first curtain? This is the first curtain. So the priest would come in behind the first curtain every day to trim the lampstands, to burn the incense they'd burn every day, and then to eat the bread once a week. But there was a second curtain that they would go behind. Now, the next picture I've got here for you, just because it's interesting, is the tabernacle, this tent, had four layers of covering on it. The first covering, let's start at the top, Exodus 26. Let's go to Exodus 26, please, so you can see it in your Bibles. Exodus 26. Two of the coverings are easy for me to be practical about. One, you're going to have the shingles on the outside to keep the rain out. And that is, in Exodus 26, verse 14, that is a covering, the NIV says, a covering of hides of sea cows. So that'd be like some kind of a porpoise. It was some kind of a sea cow. So they would be stretched out over. So if it rained, it would just run off the tent. That's practical. But of course, if you're going to go inside the temple or the tabernacle, the holy place of God, you don't want to walk in and see the shingles. You want to see some sheetrock and some paint and a little bit of decoration. And so the first one at the bottom there, the one I've got pointed there, Exodus 26, 1 through 6, describes the inner cloth. Finely twisted linen with blue, purple, and scarlet, or blue, purple, and red yarn with cherubim woven in. There is 10 curtains. They're 6 foot wide. You know, I'm 6 foot tall. By 42 feet long. And there was 10 of them. And then they would be hooked together with 50 hooks with gold clasps hooking those together. So when they got ready to take apart, they could undo the 50 clasps, roll up the 10 runs of this finely twisted garment and then go off and travel with, and they put it back together. So I understand that would be very nice. That would be elaborate. That would have the beautiful stitching in it. Some even say there was gold sewn into the cherubim, were sewn in with hammered gold, red, scarlet, purple, and then the gold. Beautiful. So that makes sense. The inside was very beautiful. So you got the shingles on the outside, you've got the beautiful decoration on the inside. But there is also two other ones. The second one was 11 curtains of goat hair connected with 50 bronze clasps. And they're designed 6 by 45, 11 of them instead of just the 10. Maybe that's the insulation. And then in Exodus 26, verse 14, the ram skins dyed red. Now, no one's going to see that red. You see what I'm saying? That would be like going in and painting the inside of your attic. You know, we've got the sheetrock that we can see that makes it pretty. We've got the insulation there to keep it warm. We've got the shingles to keep the rain out. But hey, I want to paint the inside of my attic between the insulation and the shingle. I want to paint that red. Why? Well, now maybe we're into symbolism here, if there's not symbolism here already. We're in Exodus 26, and if you want to look right here, 26 verses 1 through 6 describe the finely twisted, that first layer that was seen. Make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of finely twisted linen and blue, purple, and scarlet yarn with cherubim worked into them by a skilled craftsman. We didn't just want anybody doing this. We want someone that could do a fine job. Then you go to verse 7. Make curtains of goat hair for the tent over the tabernacle, 11 altogether. It even tells you how you're going to fold them and hang them down over the flaps. Then in verse 14, it just says, with no description, make for the tent a covering of ram skins dyed red. Of course, your instant mind would think of the blood of Christ or the blood of the sacrifices. And over that covering, the hides of sea cows. Now, there's many ways of trying to break this down. One would be the idea that on the outside, it's the skins, it doesn't look beautiful. When you walk past this thing, it didn't look beautiful at all. It looks like the hides of sea cows. But when you got inside, you actually had fine craftsmanship with gold. Those are, again, when you come to that finely twisted one, right here, as you approach this first curtain with the cherubim and the beautiful colorings, that was the first curtain. But then they'd walk past here through this second curtain. There's several discussions on what that curtain was made out of or what it looked like. Some people say it was two with about a cubit apart, so that it was wide. Some people say it was that thick as a man's hand. Some people think about it being a door at different times, in different temples and different things. But there was sewn on here also two cherubim, and they would approach that. And let's go to on page 9 there, I've got a picture behind the second curtain. There you've got the priest standing in the holy place, just outside the most holy place, getting ready to enter if there should be an incense altar there. If you look down there on page 9, the first picture towards the bottom, there you've got a priest. You can see in the background, you can see the menorah. And you can see the altar of burnt incense that we're going to talk about now. And he's offering up. And notice there's the smoke that it's rising. And that would also be releasing a fragrance that was unique to this place right here. Only here. We don't even know what that fragrance was. We don't even know the mixture. That fragrance right there was only the smell of the tabernacle. Only the smell and would only be on the priest's garments when they would leave. Let's go back to Hebrews chapter 9. And now we're into the next verse, if you don't mind. Verse 3, behind the second curtain was a room called the Most Holy Place. Again, that was 15 by 15 by 15 solid gold, which had, now here's the problem right here, which had the golden altar of incense and the gold-covered Ark of the Covenant. This ark contained the gold jar of manna, Aaron's staff that had budded, and the stone tablets of the covenant. Above the ark were the cherubim of the glory overshadowing the atonement cover, but we cannot discuss these things in detail now. Verse 4, the golden altar of incense. If we go back, if you look on the bottom of page 9, I think I've got it written out right there. By saying the incense altar was behind the curtain or in the most holy place, the writer creates a problem for us. In Exodus 30, verse 6, it says this, put the altar in front of the curtain, that is before the Ark of the Testimony, before the atonement cover, that is over the testimony, where I will meet with you. All right? So, you know, here we are. We're studying this. We're putting this all together. So you're supposed to put the altar in front of the curtain, that is before the Ark, which is covered by the atonement cover or the mercy seat. So that is the image we get. Well, if we go back and read this, if we go back to Exodus 30 and read the verses around this, it then says that the high priest is to enter here once a year, and when he does come in with that blood, the blood of the bullock for the priest and his family, the blood of the goat for the sins of the nation, when he comes in there, he is to put some on the horns of the altar. I'm not sure if you can see the horns of the altar. If you look down there on that, you can see a little bumps on the four altar corners right there. Those are the horns of the altar. There are horns on the altar of burnt offering. There's horns on this. They're symbolic. They would put blood on that. So giving the impression, if you're back here putting blood on, they'd also put blood on the mercy seat. They'd sprinkle it on the ground in front of the mercy seat. But he's also supposed to put it on the horns of this altar once a year. If you read that verse, you could assume that it is sitting right inside here in front of this Ark of the Covenant, just like the writer of Hebrews says. But then you read on in those verses, it tells the priest that each morning when he comes in to tend the lampstand, he's to burn incense on this altar, as you see here in the picture. And then each evening, again, when he comes by to deal with or trim the wicks of the lampstand, he's to burn incense again. And that's every day. So we know he only goes back here once a year. So if we just stop there and he's going to put blood on it once a year, well, it could be back here. Because you could read that, you're supposed to put it in front of the curtain that is before the Ark of the Covenant. You could read it this way. Here's the Ark of the Covenant. Here's the altar in front of the curtain that is before the Ark of the Covenant. You could read it that way too. So, but the problem is that when the priest comes in here to do the work on the ends or the candlestand, he's supposed to go over here. And he's not, we know, I would assume, he's not going back there. Oh, I'm going to run back here and burn some incense and run back, because he only goes back there once a year. So, again, that's just an interesting...
Renders two services throughout the year. He does the burnt offering for people's sins and his sins every day and every night. But when he goes in there the once a year, then that's when he does all the stuff by himself to honor everything. In other words, he renders service 364 days out of the year for us. But
right.
When he goes in there, it's the Holy of Holies. So it's two services rendered in the tabernacle within the year.
Correct.
Is what that's about.
Okay. But what I'm saying is the writer of Hebrews says the altar of incense is back here by the Ark of the Covenant on the other side of the curtain. So, I mean,
sometimes you can interpret that he's taken that altar of incense in there in the Holy of Holies.
And he does. He does. He does. He does do this. When he comes by this altar and goes in there once a year, he doesn't enter there just with the blood. He enters there with a censer. So he's taking the censer or the incense from here that's burning in a censer and walks
because
back in here with
the
it.
Prayers of the people that he
right.
takes in there. So, yes.
And that okay, Milton?
Would that be like daily would be a daily sacrifice,
mm-hmm.
and then once a year. That would be like a double portion.
Yes.
He's worshiping. That could be like a movable.
It's very small. In fact, have I given you the dimensions on it yet? That you can see right there. It's 3 foot 9 inches tall. So this is how tall this thing is. 3 foot 9 inches tall. Right. That's how tall it is. And it's 2 feet 3 inches wide. No. Excuse me. Well, I'm on the wrong thing. What am I looking at? Golden Ark of the Covenant. I'm looking at the Ark of the Covenant. I think, my gosh, this thing's going to tip over. 1 foot 6 inches. Oh, it's 3 foot tall. 3 foot tall right here. 3 foot tall right here. 1 foot 6 inches right here. That's how square it is. So it would come out from right here to right there. 3 foot tall, which is as tall as that shelf right there. So this is the altar. So it's small. It's movable. Okay. Interesting about this is we look at this, turn to page 9, and you see right there on top, or page 10, I'm sorry. The Greek word for incense altar in this verse is the Greek word thymiaterion, okay? It is used in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures. In 2 Chronicles, we could go back there and look at it, and in Ezekiel 8, it is used for the word censer. In fact, some Bible translations say this. They say, let me read it again in here. Behind the second curtain was the room called the Most Holy Place, which had the golden censer of incense and the golden covered Ark of the Covenant. So indicating that could be that would be a sensor. It is used that way. But as we read down the bullet points, but this word timaeterion means simply a place where incense is put. It doesn't mean censer. You know, it's not the word, it's not a straight translation of the English word censer. It means a place where the incense is put or a vessel for burning incense. So it could be a censer or it could be an altar of burnt incense. So it could be either one. Milton? Oh, okay. The four horns on the altar each had some kind of significance?
Yeah, each of them have a certain...
A meaning or...
Yeah.
A type.
Yeah, biblical.
Reference or connection.
Yeah.
Yes, Grace?
Leo, were you going to say something?
A censer has a removed... I'm just going from my altar left.
Yeah.
They had the censer, they had a little top on it. You put the little stuff in there and you light that, you put it down, it can just sit there. But then you pick it up and you
bless the people.
Like this.
Right.
The priest picked it up when he went in once a year.
Right, yeah, he went in here with, yeah, exactly.
That's it. That's what I was going to say. Mm-hmm. See, they.
So he did, he took the censer.
Actually, takes place in the Catholic Church like that. If any of you have ever seen that, they pull that little curtain apart, they open up the thing, they take the Holy Sacrament out, they take the censer. All these things is what they do. And then Leo Pat was an altar boy, and he blessed everyone, and then the priest takes it back, sits it in there, closes that, you're all done, go home, you're blessed.
Yep.
Yeah, well, that's what
exactly.
That's the ritual they do. It's very Jewish. I mean, it's
definitely
it's just
yep.
And all these things, the altars used to be in the olden days. The altars were like that with all those beautiful colors, right, Leo, and all of that stuff. And all, I mean, you're just describing what the Catholic Church was a few years back before it got kind of everything else. It looked just like that. We did all those things.
They copied the priesthood of the Old Testament. Yep.
Yeah, definitely. You go there sometimes, you open up the little curtain, unlock the thing, take care of it, it's all cheetah, and they take it out, and they bless you.
A lot of bells and whistles to play with.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I guess.
Well, the Orthodox Church still has a Holy of Holies.
Oh, okay.
In Moscow, when I went to Moscow,
okay.
You know, they had, like, Ivan the Terrible, him and his son are the only two that are actually buried back in the Holy of Holies part.
Of the church.
Church instead, because he wanted to be closer to God.
See, so yeah, they used
but
to bury people
yeah.
not out back behind the church cemetery. They used to bury them in
the
church.
The
yeah.
Downstairs.
Yeah, the popes who are in the Vatican are downstairs. You go down there and see Pope Pius. You can see him. He just looks like us. He's in a glass case and he looks just alive as we are. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Wow.
You can go down there and see that, sir.
Let's go to the
scary,
isn't it? We should head over to Rome. This word that could be translated censor, Herodotus, the historian, Josephus, and Philo from Alexandria, Egypt, use that same word to refer to the incense altar in the Jewish temple. So, that word, it appears to be able to use both ways, the altar or the incense burner, because it means where you put incense to burn. The thing is, to believe this word means censor, it creates a problem because what we're naming here, if you remember, we're naming parts of the furniture. The lampstand, the table, then it says, you're going to mention the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat, that it would have actually skips. We're expecting him to say the incense altar, and then for him to say censer, if anything, he would say the incense altar and the censer that was taken behind the curtain once a year. But instead he just used that word. Maybe he's actually just referring to this and the process and putting these two things together in one statement. Again, it's just hanging there wanting to have some kind of explanation. Okay, there it is. I mean, because that causes some problems for people when they read that, because like, wait a minute, we're always drawing these diagrams, we're always reading parts of the Old Testament, the incense altar is right here, but also on the right of Hebrews says, oh, it's on this side of the curtain. I mean, did all of a sudden they move it there one day, or how did this happen? Milton?
Also, did that have something to do, because, you know, when they went in there, they, you know, like the priest, he had a certain, in his garments,
the
certain meanings, and,
right.
You know, when he went in there every year, he had to be cleaned up and stuff.
Certain rituals.
Wouldn't that be part of that with the stuff you put on
the fragrance, the incense?
Would that be part of that also?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, let's read it one more time here, and we're going to talk about the Ark of the Covenant real quick. Behind the second curtain was a room called the Most Holy Place, which had the golden altar of incense and the gold-covered Ark of the Covenant. Now, let's read about this right. Notice what it says. It never just says the Ark of the Covenant. It always mentions the Ark and the covering together, the Ark and the covering together. One reason it's a big deal for the writer of Hebrews, because he's already talked about, let us approach, in chapter 4, verse 6, I believe it was, let us approach the throne of grace. Let us approach the throne of grace. And that throne of grace, in his mind, it's pretty clear. If that's the Ark of the Covenant, and this is the mercy seat with the cherubim hammered into it, this right here is the throne of grace. And again, we're going to look at that some more, because that is the throne of, that's where the Lord's presence was manifested right here. And so this is the throne of grace. So he's never going to mention the box, the Ark of the Covenant, without mentioning the covering. And the two really aren't, I mean, when we say the Ark of the Covenant, we think the box with the covering. But it's really two different things. He's always going to mention. Now, here's a little bit about the Ark of the Covenant. What time is it getting to be, Tony?
It is 8:44.
Okay, we better wrap this up here. Boy. Especially when this says right here, but we cannot discuss these things in detail now. It's like kind of violating the whole mood of the book right here. And again, I spent a whole week, I think 15 hours one week, teaching through the tabernacle. And it's just nonstop, all the connections and things. Leo?
Question. When Christ was crucified, mm-hmm. How close was he to this temple? Was this the temple he was close to?
Okay, what we're talking about right here is the tabernacle. But when we talk about the temple, it's very, very close, Leo.
What we're talking about is the veil that was split.
Right.
Which veil? Was that the veil to the Holy Spirit?
That would be that second, yep, right here. So if we draw this, now we draw the temple. Here's the holy, most holy place. This is the veil, the curtain that was torn from top to bottom. And this is the Ark of the Covenant that is sitting right here. Okay, let's see if I can draw this real quick here. I'm not sure I can make sense out of this. Here is the Temple Mound. Okay, this is the Temple Mound. The temple would have stood right here. The Dome of the Rock is right about here, right now, the Muslim place. This is the Western Wall. This is the, this is where you can see the picture. Like I said on my website, you can see a picture of this all the time right here. And this is where people go and they touch the wall. That's the foundation wall. This is not the wall. We've talked about that before, too. All right, oh boy, here you go. You guys ready? That's Mount Moriah many years ago when Abraham went up here and on a rock offered Isaac. Okay? Well, now David buys that. Solomon's going to build a temple. Solomon builds a wall around this place like this. It's got to be higher than that. He builds a wall around this temple mount, Mount Moriah, like this. Okay? A wall. And fills this all in. See this? This is all filled in. Now, that's backfill. That's dirt, whatever. Stone, gravel. And then on top of here, now they've got a temple mound. This is still here today, still flat. You can still walk on this day. All this stuff is gone. But apparently there's one place where the rock, you can still see the rock on the top of the Mount Moriah. They say that's where the Dome of the Rock is sitting on. In fact, they used to be able to go back in there, and we could have toured that this summer if it was 5-10 years ago. But some Orthodox Jew went in there loaded with dynamite or something. We're going to blow the place up. They said, no one's coming in here anymore. Okay, but anyway, this right here is the Western Wall. So if you stood by the Western Wall, you're standing right here outside, up on top of here now. They built the wall that would go around the temple, and then the temple would be standing right inside of here. Okay? Does that make sense? Are you with me? Does that make any sense at all? Okay. So now, Leo, this is the Western Wall. Now we're looking from the top down. Here's the Temple Mound. Here's where the temple would have been. The Dome of the Rock is right here. Fort Antonia was right here. You can still see the base of it, the rock base of where that used to be. It's now a school. It's built on top of that, an old school. Then the wall of the ancient city, of course, see, like this was, the city of David was down here. This was the small part of the city of David. And this was an expansion of the city when they bought the Mount Moriah. And they added the temple.
Well, the city grew this way a little bit in Hezekiah's day. It grew way over on the other side, over in this part. So the city of Jerusalem got, you know, pretty big. But even then, in Jesus' day, the walls of the city went something like this. Okay? Today, the walls of the city are bigger. You know, it extended further north. My point. Jesus was tried right out here on the pavement in front of Fort Antonia. They led him through the streets outside the city walls to this place right here called Golgotha, which was like a quarry, if you would. And there he was crucified on a cross on the main road leading into town. So when you came into town, he would walk by everybody being crucified. Don't mess around. It's kind of like a, you know, speed zone. It's like, Romans are here. Don't mess around. You'd come into the city for Passover. It's like, ooh, what'd that guy do? It's like a warning. Don't mess around in Jerusalem. Well, Jesus is pinned up there on the cross. He dies and is buried in a grave right close to there. This today is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's impossible to recognize because there's buildings, building upon building, connected to building all around here. And it's been occupied by churches and religious groups. I think there's something like 15 different churches have possessions within that church, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre today. Which means, in fact, when they unlock the door each morning, it is unlocked by a Muslim. Because the churches couldn't get along, they finally negotiated. And it's been that way for like 150, 200 years now, that this Muslim family has had the key to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And one of the members every day unlocks the door and allows but otherwise they're going to fight. They're going to fight. You can see, I got some pictures of this. Up towards the top of the building, here's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Here's the door that you come into. You can see there's a second floor up here, and there's a little window right here. And there's a ladder leaning against one of these windows right here like that. Just a little wooden ladder. It's been there like for 100 years. But it's not our job to move that ladder. You need to take the ladder down. We didn't put it there. Well, you take it down. No one will touch the ladder. And it's become now a symbol of power that we ain't going to move the ladder. No one wants to move no one will touch the ladder. And it's in every picture, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, every picture has got that ladder leaning against the wall right there. Now, when we were there, Jennifer Rausch, Jennifer, Ryan, me, and Tony went. She tried to convince me and Tony and Ryan to one night go there and take that ladder down. Oh, she's a brave soul. So, yeah, Leo, this crucifixion was right here. In fact, now that you understand possibly Mount Moriah, which has got a wall built around it with dirt, you understand how many tunnels are underneath here. It's full of tunnels. And in fact, when you in the old days, on the south side of the Temple Mount, there's gates where they used to go in these gates and go like going to a ballpark. You'd go up in elevation and come out on the Temple Mount up here. You'd go in this gate and walk up the walkway. So that you could tunnel through them real easy. So there's tunnels all about inside of here. Some Jews, if we look at this, so this is the south side. Some Jews started on, I think it was on this side, but they got into some tunnels here, and they were coming through, and they came up on this side. Now, see, right about in here, on the outside, this is Muslim quarters. This is Jewish quarters. It's not a problem over here, but if you're tunneling right here, you tunnel underneath the mosque, the holy site, then you tunnel through, and you come up here on the street, hey, guess who here? Like 15 people were killed that day, just a few years ago. Because it's like, hey, we tunneled through we came through the tunnels. It's like, no, you didn't, and they were shot on sight by the Muslims. It's like, don't be tunneling in our place here. And we walked right by there. We walked right down here and saw the tunnel. But we went into some tunnels here, and you can see it. But anyway, there's so many tunnels. Some, again, we'll get into this next week a little bit. The theory, one theory, this is not scripture, but one theory, if Jesus was crucified right here, it's close enough to the temple that if Jeremiah, who knew the Babylonians were coming, and the ark isn't taken, the ark is gone. Something happens to the ark. One of the theories and then we'll get into this next week. One of the theories is that when the priests saw the Babylonians were coming, that they threw the ark up into the air, and it just kept going. And God took it into heaven. That's one. Where's the ark go? That's one answer. One of the answers is Jeremiah, who was a priest. But if you read it right around chapter 7 or so of Jeremiah, he was kicked out of the temple, couldn't come back because he didn't have a good message. He said, God's going to destroy this temple. We don't want you preaching that anymore. Go away. And so he couldn't come back. But if he did get in the temple, that he would have maybe even Josiah helped. build a there were tunnels. There's tunnels. They're always discovering tunnels. They would have used a tunnel system to move the ark somewhere and hide it until the end times when it will be revealed. Which then, when Jesus was dying on the cross, his blood would have dripped into the ground, and there's cracks, and would have dropped through the cracks and landed on the mercy seat where the blood had always been landing from and was the final atonement. Great story. It's possible. The problem with that is the book of Hebrews is all about this temple is temporary. It's all passing away. But yet we have a tendency to, wait. The magical ark has to have Jesus' blood touch it. And it's like that's exciting to think about, but really the whole book of Hebrews is that the blood of Jesus is going to be used in the holy place, holy of holy places in heaven, not on an ark somewhere. But it's still, you know, there's several legends. I got them written down here, several ideas on what happened to the ark. One idea, which is possible but a sad one, is the Babylonians took it like they did everything else, but there was so much gold in it and such good gold that it's like, let's melt this thing down. They melted down the ark. That's true, Leo. But if you remember, the ark was built by man and carried in by man and placed in the temple or the tabernacle. And then both in the tabernacle on a particular day and in Solomon's temple, the presence of the Lord moved into the temple. The ark itself was the presence of God, not the box. And in Ezekiel chapter 10, you have the presence of God leaving the temple. In the actual see the cherubim and the actual chariot of God, the living God actually leaving, which I believe in Ezekiel 10 and 11, the glory has left the temple, which means what's left? A box.
Who was moving it? Was it Daniel who was moving the
Art, David. David was bringing it back.
David,
mm-hmm.
And one of the men that was carrying mm-hmm. it touched it. So was the Spirit of God in that?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Here's the Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea. Here's Shiloh. Remember? Not Shiloh. Yeah, Shiloh. Burnt to the ground. Philistines took it. They passed it around. They had the plagues break out. They handed it back and they sent it over here and put it into Israel put it in a foreign place. The day it arrived in Kerith Jearim, a bunch of men ran up to look inside of it and they all died. Listen, the Philistines brought it back because it was killing them and giving them hemorrhoids. That's what the Bible says.
That's a hemorrhoid yeah. story.
Hemorrhoids and rats. And they said, we don't want this. In fact, they honored God when they put it on the ark or the cart and sent it back. They made 5 golden rats and 5 golden hemorrhoids, and their priest brought it and laid it before the box. Holy, holy God of the rats and hemorrhoids. And they honored. It's like God is saying, he's the God of the universe. He's the creator of the sea. He's the creator of the stars. He's the creator of man himself. But to the Philistines, I'm going to reveal myself as the God of the rats and the hemorrhoids. I mean, that's funny stuff. I mean, that's funny. God, he revealed, what are the Philistines? He's the God of the hemorrhoids. Yeah, so great God of hemorrhoids and rats. Yeah, whatever he is. But he's a little bit bigger too, but that's all they understood. That's all he cared. That's good enough. Well, they bring it back, and when the Israelites saw it, they looked in it. A bunch of them died. A few years later, David decides to bring it to Jerusalem, and they're dancing and celebrating, and they're bringing it there, and all of a sudden, classic, I'm sorry, we got to quit. Classic story. How does the book of Exodus tell them to carry the Ark of the Covenant? With the poles, with the blue tarp on it. It gives them details. Don't mess it up. Everything's a teaching lesson. Well, the Philistines put it on they said, how are we going to bring it? They said, well, put it on a cart with two mother cows. And they sent it back. Well, the God says, that's fine enough. I've only revealed myself as the God of hemorrhoids and rats. And they really took it. They brought 5 of each. So that's good enough. Well, the Israelites have the written revelation on how to carry it. So what do they do? They don't go to the scriptures. They don't go to the priests and the Levites and ask, what are we supposed to do with this thing? They went to guess who? The Philistine tradition. They put it on a cart and started bringing it back. And as the cart rocks a little bit, and one of the priests reaches up and saves it from tipping over, he saves God and drops dead. Because obviously from Shiloh all the way through, God's presence is there. Then David brings it there, puts it in the temple, or Solomon puts it in the temple. The Lord moves into that temple, and his presence is there again. But then in Ezekiel chapter 10 and 11, the glory of God leaves. And at that point, I believe it's nothing but a dead building. The glory has left. The presence of God has left. You could walk in there and do whatever you want to with it. And again, at that point, if Nebuchadnezzar had come back there, they would have pulled the curtain back, go, hey, cool box of gold. Let's take it back and melt it down. No problem. Nothing. They wouldn't have had any trouble.